Morning, Your Honors. We're here to help. I forgot to tell you, I'm Charles McFarland. I represent Mr. Selkis. I'm from Kentucky. We're here today to correct a conviction that should have never legally or factually happened. Mr. Selkis was convicted of two criminal offenses, income tax evasion of the payment of taxes, and also the conspiracy under Section 371. I will primarily be addressing the evasion of the payment of taxes in today's argument, because the 371 conspiracy rises and falls based on what happens with the evasion of the payment of taxes crime. Mr. Selkis was convicted of evasion of the payment of taxes for the years 1998 to 2002 and for the year 2005. Even though the taxes from 1998 to 2002 were fully paid, and the deposit was paid by Mr. Selkis for the year 2005. The taxes for the years 1998 to 2002 were paid by the CHIP data withholder. And the taxes for the 2005, Mr. Selkis made a deposit of $14,850 when he filed his return. And that was paid for by a deposit was made by a check that accompanied the return. And it was reported everything that was on his return. And because the prosecution was unable to prove a, quote, tax deficiency in this case, the charges against Mr. Selkis should be remanded. The reason for this is because had the tax deficiency been presented to the jury, they would have discovered that the payment of taxes from 1998 to 2002 was actually paid. He made a deposit for 2005, and the IRS failed to show follow the Internal Revenue Code for determining what the tax deficiency was. Had they had that information, it would have been a different verdict by the jury. I want to point out that the indictment was very, very specific. Thomas Selkis was charged in count two with evasion of the payment of taxes. Count two, he specifically was charged with payment of taxes, failure to pay taxes, evading that for the years 1998 and for the year 2005. So there were two periods of time that were involved in this. And because of this two periods of time, we have to look at the two different periods and what happened. Taxes from 1998 to 2002 were fully paid. I'm going to address that in a few minutes, but I wanted to start with 2005. Taxes for 2005 were not due and owing because the IRS did not follow the tax deficiency procedures.
But this whole trial, counsel, this whole trial went forward on the basis of a evasion of payment theory. It's about a trial. It was all about evasion. What I'm getting at in the constructive amendment argument is that the trial was conducted of a theory that goes forward.
Does not happen until there is a tax return filed and a deposit made, and the IRS goes through the procedure of determining the tax deficiency. Once that tax deficiency is determined, it's a notice of deficiency is sent out, and it goes to tax court, or the person doesn't pay, go to the tax court, they send out a notice of deficiency, or a notice of demand, and the tax is not due and owing per law until that notice of demand is sent out. Mr. Selfridge did pay his 2005, what he calculated as his tax and reported it. And I just want to make that clear. Anyhow, what's happened here is throughout the course of the legal action on Section 1071, almost all courts treat these two crimes as one crime. But the Sansone case made it clear there were two crimes. One is evasion of the assessment, and one is evasion of the payment of taxes. And that's been recently decided in 2012. And the elements of the crime are willfulness, tax deficiency, and an affirmative act. But Mr. Selfridge was only charged with evasion of the payment of taxes, not the assessment. And the Fifth Circuit has never addressed that particular issue where somebody filed a return, made a deposit. So they've never addressed that particular issue. So this is the case of first impression. So the question is, what is the legal definition of tax deficiency, which is what the courts are supposed to follow? Tax deficiency is when somebody files a tax return and reports what they made and paid it, then the IRS makes a determination based on that return that additional taxes are owed. That is a tax deficiency. But it does not become, yes.
That just sounds like a legal argument to me about what the definition of it is, what the definition is for tax deficiency. And I guess I maybe misunderstood your claim, because I thought your claim one on a constructive amendment, you're claiming that there was an amendment constructively to an indictment because of the use of the language evasion of assessment and then evasion of payment.
No, that wasn't the constructive amendment I was talking about. The constructive amendment I was talking about was where the judge made an instruction that the jury could find him guilty of a felony or of a failure to pay. And my argument was addressed at what the definition of a tax deficiency was. Okay? And
so who misinterpreted or misread the definition of tax deficiency? Where did that error occur?
I would be saying that the court misinterpreted what the tax deficiency was way back in
the district court did.
No, Sansone did. The Supreme Court. Sansone used tax deficiency, and in Sansone case, there was no tax deficiency. There are three ways that you can have a tax due and owing. One way is there's no tax return filed. Tax is due and owing on April 15th. Second way is when a person files a tax return and reports his tax but doesn't pay it. That is also a tax due and owing. It's not a tax deficiency. The third way is what I've already explained, is when they determine there's a tax deficiency and they go through the tax court process, and after the notice of demand comes in, the law says that, I think it's under 6215 and 6213, the law says that if the tax is not due until that notice of demand is sent. So there is a difference between a tax deficiency and a tax due and owing. And the Sansone case listed tax deficiency when it should be saying tax due and owing in that case. And that's what I'm looking at here is the element of a tax deficiency only comes up when a person files a tax return and pays something, and then the IRS determines there is a tax deficiency. That's the only place in the code where a tax deficiency comes up.
Let me ask you a question about
yes.
From 2007 to 2017, a 10-year period, mm-hmm. Your client deposited more than $857,000 into Green, the lawyer, a trust account, the IOLT, the lawyer that maintained such a trust fund. And they had paid all their expenses over a period of 10 years out of it when they needed the money came out of that account.
Okay.
Can you give me an explanation for that arrangement?
Yes, I can. The reason for that is
other than the obvious.
Okay. First of all, on the IOLTA situation, there's three reasons for why that IOLTA account is there. First of all, the IRS never notified Mr. Selvers of the 1998 to 2002 tax returns. They were paid by tax return. It was filed. The IRS credited him in 2 years, well, immediately when he filed them in 2006. 2 years later, they reversed it and never sent him a notice about it. The second thing is, there was no notice ever sent to him about 2005. So the question about the IOLTA is really kind of a going off track here, because the IOLTA, the IRS was saying he was trying to hide it from the IRS, but he didn't know he owed anything and didn't have any notice he owed anything. What he did with the IOLTA is basically immaterial. The second part of it is tax deficiency was not sent out on 2005. And the third issue is Ms. Selvers testified earlier that Mr. Selvers had had problems earlier with banks, and he didn't trust banks. And he discovered that in Texas, when an IOLTA is used, the client is the one that owns the IOLTA. But the Supreme Court in Shaw versus the United States, I believe it was the 2016 case, made it clear that when a person makes a deposit in the bank owns it. And it's kind of like an equity ownership of it, because they can loan his money out, so they own it. And he didn't trust the bank, so he put it in the IOLTA. And that's the primary reason he did that. That didn't come out at the trial, except through Ms. Selvers' testimony. So
I put money in an IOLTA so the bank couldn't loan it out to somebody? Is that what you're saying?
Basically, yeah. Because he wanted to own his own property, and he'd already lost some money years ago from the bank. He had borrowed some money from someplace, and the bank came in and closed out his account, and he lost money on it. That was one of the reasons why he did it. That never came up at the trial. But and through his attorney, he found out he could put the money in the IOLTA based on the bank.
It's that the same reason that you transferred the residence in Athens, Texas, to the son-in-law of the trust?
That is a excuse me, I'm gonna say something. I hope you understand. That characterization is a bald-faced lie. That not to you, but was said by the IRS. The trust was set up by the father-in-law, who paid the money into the trust. It was his own money. He paid for the trust.
The effect of that essentially was to prevent the government from discovering the title to it. In fact, it didn't succeed in doing that.
No, it didn't. What happened was the IRS, first of all, the IRS did not have any legal reason to collect because they hadn't sent out any notice or anything. But the trust was paid for in gold coin, which was equivalent to over $300,000. It was paid for.
A question not directed to the method of payment of your gold theories, except it is directed to the proposition that I'm sure the government argued this jury that you're evading income taxes, to put it directly, and that you put all your money with a lawyer and all the counsel, they don't know where it is, and you have a resident. You go over to buy a property in Athens, Texas, and then if they're in chain of title, well, then you put that in another trust to get that out. I'm just saying to you that why is the jury reasonably conclude that this is you put the picture together, this is nothing but an effort to avoid income taxes.
Excuse me, the reason why the jury couldn't figure that out is because the government misrepresented that trust. That trust was not a nominal transfer. That trust, the father-in-law paid without
the
money.
The effect of the trust was to prevent someone from looking at the chain of title, looking
No, the reason the trust was set up because Mr. Self.
My question is not whether a jury is not reasonably able to conclude from that.
Well, they can conclude. They can conclude what you just said because that's what was misrepresented to them. The trust was not a nominal transfer. It was purchased outright. And it was purchased for the reason that Mr. Selvis was going through cancer treatment and needed money, so his father bought the trust for that. So
did he not argue that to the jury?
No, we didn't because we didn't have. I got involved in the case just before the trial started, didn't know all of this, and the other attorney didn't. So I say my time is up.
$14,000 something check that he sent in for his 2005 taxes, which should have been at least 10 times higher. Mr. Zelgus hasn't paid his taxes. And not only has he not paid his taxes, he has made every effort possible to hide it from the government, to hide it from the IRS. And he has played this game with the IRS in different iterations for well over a decade. A decade was what he was putting his money in Green's IOLTA. The court properly instructed the jury on the elements of tax evasion, including the necessity for an affirmative act of evasion, and that Zelgus was not on trial for any act, conduct, or offense not alleged in the indictment. The government did not allege failure to file at any point. Failure to file wasn't alleged as part of the evasion payment case. It was not alleged even as part of the conspiracy. In fact, the only...
Let me ask you a question. What was the total taxable income for which taxes were not paid?
Oh, goodness. From, I think, 2002 was primarily paid because there were withholdings that year. From 98 to 2001 was probably a couple of hundred thousand income. But the big haul was the My Mail distribution in 2005. And that was approximately $1.3 million of income that Mr. Zelgus did not report on a tax return. Now, he's going to claim that he did make a tax return, but he actually just filed a false statement with the government, with the IRS, substantially undervaluing that distribution.
And that statement wasn't a return, was it?
No, it was not a return. He claims it was what's called a Beard return, which is basically something designed to determine whether the statute of limitations applies when you're attempting to determine whether the return was filed on time. The Beard return is simply a way of allowing someone to file their return if they don't have access to the proper forms. His statement was not a return. It was not even a Beard return. In fact, the statement shown at trial, the 2005 statement, wasn't even signed, much less signed under penalty of perjury. Had it been signed, and I do believe that there must be a version somewhere, this is a version the government got from Zelgus, it must have been signed at one point because we know that the government deposited the check. But even had he signed the document that was entered into evidence, it was not signed under penalty of perjury. Those words did not appear. And it was not, in fact, Your Honor, a good faith effort to report his taxes to the IRS. I can address the other issues as well if Your Honor would like. If you have no further questions, then I will be happy to give my time back to you. The government asks that you affirm Mr. Zelgus's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. I would specifically like to address very, very quickly on the trust. Mr. Zelgus was given a life estate, and the trust was geared for the father-in-law's grandchildren. They would take over after his life estate, so it wasn't a purpose of hiding him. It was to pay his medical expenses. Second of all, I want to address the Beard return. You're probably asking why the Beard return. Well, the Beard return is authorized in the Fifth Circuit, and it has been followed by the Beard versus the Commissioner, And there are certain requirements that have to be there. When Mr. Selvas filed his 2005 statement, he listed the requirements of the Deer Commissioner case in there, put them all in there, and he did sign it under perjury. Problem is when the IRS received that, they didn't process it. Their Internal Revenue Manual said they're supposed to process deer returns. They didn't process it, even though it was filed. They sent it to Ogden, and they got a copy that Mr. Selvas had that wasn't signed. It was his copy. But the original signature is someplace in Ogden, and it's in the possession of the IRS, and it was signed under penalty of perjury. And he listed all the requirements of the beard return, and his purpose of filing that beard return was not to evade taxes. He was challenging something that had nothing to do with taxes. He was challenging the Secretary of Treasury's requirements under Title 31, Section 5119, that he was supposed to keep the Federal Reserve notes and the gold concurrency in equal purchasing power. And he was trying to challenge that. And he actually paid, he took $1,850, or $485, gold coins. He actually tried to pay the IRS that. The IRS rejected it 7 times. That was in the transcript testified by John Green, who accompanied him with that. Then, when he calculated his taxes, he based it on the gold standard, and he came up with the $14,480. And he took that money to the bank and paid them that gold. And they only gave him a check of $14,850. But when you look at the last two pages of his return, he points out that he paid the bank in the same amount of gold that he started off the pay. So he paid $1,600,000 in taxes, trying to pay to start off with. And then when he went to the bank, he told the bank, this is $1,485, and that's on his statement. That's what he did. The bank took it and only gave him a $14,000 check. Then he sent that to the IRS and told them to redeem it according to Title 12, Section 411, which the IRS didn't do. Instead, they wanted to charge him with failing to pay. So contrary to what the counsel's saying, he did pay his taxes. But the problem is the IRS never got it because of the court of law, which is basically a situation where you've got, even today, in today's society, people are concerned about inflation. He was addressing that way back when, back in 2005. You take a $10 gold coin to the bank and they'll only give you a $10 bill, even though it's worth $500 today. And there's something wrong with that kind of a situation. And for somebody to be trying to change, point out the inequity in the law, to charge him with the evasion of taxes when he tried 7 different times to pay it in gold coins, and the IRS rejected it. The same thing happens in 1998 to 2002. He went to tax court, and this is the one thing that really is you should understand. The IRS said he was not allowed to withhold him because of the tax court. There's not a single tax court existence that says Tom Selvas was not allowed to withhold. That was his wife. They called him a non-tax petitioner. I never heard that term before. The new term. She was there individually, and they said she couldn't take the withholding. But when he went to court on his own, they said he could. So they're telling the jury he wasn't allowed to withhold. That's why he didn't pay his taxes. So, unless you have any questions, I